Most of us like to be out in the sun. That's why sunscreen and other safety measures are key to protecting your skin from aging and cancer. The FDA recommends using a sunscreen with an SPF of 15 or higher. Also, look for broad spectrum on the label. That means both harmful ultraviolet A and B rays are blocked. Remember, SPF plus broad spectrum equal healthy fun in the sun. Visit www.fda.gov/sunscreen for more information. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so, I mean, I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. I mean, they look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the, you know, the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or to look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious, to what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure, you know, you're aware that I hold on this matter?
Yeah, I'd say, in all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food and water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book, we already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve, because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive, which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone has enough? And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die in that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in the section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And mm-hmm. you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. You know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You'll look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California mm-hmm. and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again on your front of things? It would appear that your position to an extent requires some amount of subsidizing demand or doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to like universal housing. How do I put this? Like you were saying, like rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live. Just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. All of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. I was going to pick up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. Austin has grown so, so much. You can look at a skyline picture of like Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants, rents are also super low in Austin. And there's like two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You ask anybody in Houston,
Dallas, do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to like provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Off the top of my head, but yeah,
maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but...
a lot of people, we'll put it that way.
They have, in their entire country, about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the US, there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous welfare system there that kind of just doesn't accept homelessness as this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
at Tokyo also has very, very, you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, and that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street. So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing, because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets. So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, it's not, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. There was a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to the illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's either of ill intent or not, I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it is a crossing that is not legal. So I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly what you think.
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things. You know, you can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times, this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
It's the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news. Get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case by case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case by case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here. And it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah. And I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement that, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. Imagine. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious, to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken, and I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. I would assume this is of a broad sort of heady general what do we think here, but I'm is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what like a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two. Basically the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those you believe, not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways, I'm an old school guy. you know, I, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because, and I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this, in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there, when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think that's the type of model I would want. I would want sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal static income levels. And this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's ultimately the primary provider, you know, and mm-hmm. this kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like the kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah. And you know, at the same time, you know, the woman, you know, can, and she has the desire to do so, should pursue, you know, a source of income as well. But, you know, the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, you know, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of both men and women in just kind of how there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry, this is the case. I mean, you know, obviously we're not, you know, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But, you know, there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on, you know, mm-hmm. what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. You know, it is.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern. You know, the coffee, but whatever you wanted, the salon. So, but anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having, you know, an actual guest on the show once again. But I'll send you all off with this. You all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
If you're listening to this recording, it means that I am dead. So this won't be a live show this week, but we've still got some great music lined up for you on WRCT Pittsburgh's The Atom Smasher. First up, we'll do a couple of songs off of Sandpiper's new album, Outdoor Shower. You can find these guys on the typical streaming platforms. After that, some more new music from our music directors before passing it over to our automated tracks, followed by Dream Suite at 9 p.m. All this and more on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Sorry to know you like that. Symmetrical ways that you act. It's nothing that's sweat off my back. So why is this feeling so bad? I'm sorry I know you. I'm not feeling so cool. I strung through this whirlpool with nothing else to do. I'm feeling so
All right, that's a wrap on Sandpiper. Again, those tracks were from their newest album, Outdoor Shower. We'll be switching it up with some tracks now from our music directors, followed by, again, Dream Suite at 9 p.m.
Is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year. Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.lymediseaseassociation.org.
I'm Lisette Martinez, and I approve this message.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, one in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
There was just enough room to cram the drums in the corner over by the Dodge. It was a 54 with a mashed up door and a cheesy little lamp, with a sign on the front said Fender Champ and a second hand guitar. It was a Stratocaster with a whammy bar. We could jam in Joe's garage. His mama was screaming, his dad was sad. We was playing the same old song in the afternoon, and sometimes we would play it all night long. It was all we knew and easy too, so we wouldn't get it wrong. All we did was bend the string like, hey, down in Joe's garage. We didn't have no dope or but a couple of quarts of beer would fix it, so the intonation would not offend your ear. And the same old chords going over and over became a symphony. We could play it again and again and again, cause it sounded good to me. One more time. We could jam in Joe's garage. His mama was screaming, turn it down. We was playing the same old song in the afternoon, and sometimes we were playing all night long. It was all we knew, and easy too, so we wouldn't get it wrong. Even if you played it on the saxophone. Good. We talked about keeping the band together. We figured that we should, cause about this time we was getting the eye from the girls in the neighborhood. They'd all come over and dance around like, so we kicked out a stupid name, had some cards printed up for a couple of bucks, and we was on our way to fame. Got matching suits and beetle boots and a sign on the back of the car, and we was ready to work in a go-go bar.
Get one chance in life to play a song that goes like,
we That was Joe's first confrontation with the law. Naturally, we were easy on him. One of our friendly counselors gave him a donut and told him to stick closer to church-oriented social activity.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
We don't want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias.
Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition. Reach the audience.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
To Massive Music Weekend on WRCT Pittsburgh. From Friday at noon to Sunday at midnight, we'll be spending 60 straight hours of our favorite artists and bands, including live performances from five local bands. You can visit WRCT.org to view the full schedule for our annual music marathon. Piatta Italian Street Food is a spot for fresh chopped salads, tossed pastas, and toasted piattas, their take on an Italian-style wrap. With five locations in the Pittsburgh area, they've got options to satisfy a variety of cravings. You can find Piatta in the Northway Mall, East Liberty Shadyside area, Oakland on Pitt's campus, South Hills near Mount Lebanon, and in the South Hills Robinson area. You can follow Piatta on Instagram at Piatta Italian Street Food to stay up to date on all things Piatta. I've gotten a half hour of antenna. Yeah. This is Camino del Sol, their title song, the title track off of the release Camino del Sol.
Christ.